It's a big thing in Canada, so I suppose.
Well, that and curling.
But that probably won't take long. I think the discussion on the branding would be just a good thing to cover. And the DC Squared multiverse. I don't know if many people have a huge comment on that, but...
DC makes a motion comic, yay.
Well, it's supposed to be a choose-your-own-adventure comic.
One of them is, and then the other one is... it's just supposed to be like a comic, but it's interactive, and how...
Motion comics suck anyways. Every time I see one, it's like Clutch Cargo.
The execution on those things tends to always be pretty gimmicky.
Well, like I said, it looks like Clutch Cargo. Have you? Who remembers Clutch Cargo?
I think we've
lost me on that one.
I think we've established that Ben, you know everybody.
No, Clutch Cargo was a cartoon from a couple of decades back where the animation was really, really, really bad. Where basically all it was still images, and they just showed they superimposed an actor's lips.
No. Oh, that.
I know that style, yeah. Ugh.
Do you have a link?
Oh, boy, one second.
I think there was a clip of that in the Pulp Fiction movie. I think it was on TV briefly. During the
Clutch Cargo was on the TV more than briefly.
No, I meant in that scene. In a scene in Pulp Fiction, during the Ass Watch flashback.
There's Clutch Cargo.
Let's check this out. Oh, okay, yeah.
But see, the thing is, this is actually drawn to look good on the television, while Clutch Cargo looks like shit. This is actually drawn while Motion Comics look like shit because Motion Comics are, you know, just the comic book where someone uses Adobe Flash to make something move, like an arm move or something, and it looks really shit. Like super shit.
Well, I mean, even back during the 60s, this was back during the 50s, and so this was actually quite a bit of work. But yeah, I mean, nowadays with Flash, you can do the same shit in just minutes.
Except it looks bad.
Oh, it looks awful.
I mean, there was a what was it called? Marvel did like a bunch of motion comics where they took pre-existing comic books and hired a bunch of college students to use Flash for 5 minutes to turn them into motion comics, and it was absolute utter shit. It was like there was one for Black Panther, which was, oh my god, that one was so shit.
So how is this related to our topics today?
Because they were talking about DC Comics doing a motion comic.
Ah, there we go.
And I said the motion comics remind me of Clutch Cargo.
Okay, do you have a link for that that podcast guy then?
Yeah, let me grab it really quick. Well, Clutch Cargo also has an interesting story for that's actually related to Doctor Who.
How so?
Are we still talking about Clutch Cargo?
Well, it's an interesting topic that I happen to know a lot about. What happened was... was in the Chicago area. In the Chicago area, someone somehow hijacked a television station's broadcast while they were showing Doctor Who.
Yeah,
and it was a guy wearing a Max Headroom mask.
I heard about that. Yeah,
spanking himself while humming the Clutch Cargo theme.
Oh, is that what he was doing?
Yes,
that's pretty tangential there. So I do see where Conan O'Brien now got the mouth thing from.
Yeah, yes, that's
absolutely creepy.
It is the truth. That is what happened.
I love the little boy with the woman's lips.
And this all of this.
Yes, that's now the police are going to be asking you questions.
And this is how Annoying Orange eventually came into being.
I guess so, yeah. Yes, the NSA is recording this as we're making it.
Yeah, I couldn't find anything that would well relate that to anything that we'd talk about on the show, so I didn't include it.
General American cultural phenomenon, but...
Alright, are we ready to go ahead and figure something out and get started?
You're listening to the Webcomic Beacon at webcomicbeacon.com.
Hello and welcome to another edition of the Webcomic Beacon here at webcomicbeacon.com, part of the Webcast Beacon Network at webcastbeacon.com, covering and promoting creativity and the creative process since 2007. And we're here with, we got a few people here with us today. We do have Ben Carver returning once again. Don't know for how long if he keeps interrupting the beginning of the show. From Animation Aficionados, welcome, I think, back.
Well, I do what I can to keep the show interesting.
Try harder. And we also have returning Terrence McManus from AJ Comic, Average Joe. Welcome back to the show.
G'day, everyone. Hello, all internet citizens.
And returning once again, and I want to say return. You were actually on one episode thus far. Is that correct? We have
one episode thus far.
Monty Road from a DeviantArt link, which I'll put in the Monty Road at DeviantArt.
It's on DeviantArt. It has its own little Facebook page, and it also has Tumblr and. I have a few little people drifting to it, but yeah, I'm kind of invisible, but anyways.
We do have a news and commentary episode this week for May 9th, 2013. Not really a whole lot of spectacular news, but we're going to go through with what we have thus far. And starting it off, 2013 Joe Shuster Awards. The nominees have been announced. Now, which one of you guys put this one up, and they can take it from here?
I'm the guilty party there. I found this one when I was having a look over the Webcomics Overlook. They had a link through to it on their site there. And yeah, it's a Canadian award for – this is the web cartoonist category. I'm not too sure. Is there other categories around for this award besides just web cartoons?
But we don't care about those, so.
No. The important part.
My spoon is too big.
Oh, God. No.
You mentioned web cartoons. That's the first thing that pops in my head.
I am a banana. All right, let's go.
So there's a few of these that are kind of familiar. Ant Comic is here again. We saw that one come up. Was that the Rubens that one was brought up into? Yep.
There's been a few award stuff thus far already that we've been talking about. So this one's Canadian.
Yeah. And it's good. There's a couple of there's even a couple of ones in there for the Francophones. Couple of French little cartoons, so it's a good little couple of comics to check out.
And Comic comes back again. Ant Comic.
If you need your fix of large ant vajayjay, there it is. You can click through again.
Yeah, there's some diversity in this one. Sadly, compared to the more American ones, there's a lot more variety in this selection. I am actually, I like that a lot.
Yeah, there's definitely a very wide variety of work represented here.
So we'll have to.
There's some really sort of artsy things compared to your regular sort of strip type comedy and things there. It's quite nice.
Yoka Dave, Slice of Life. Video games.
It's like they got one of everything in here almost.
Yeah.
So we'll follow up on the Joe Shuster Awards when they have winners. And let's see here. We've actually had Adam Huber, the focus of the next article on an older episode of the Webcomic Beacon. And he does a webcomic called Bug, or apparently now he's calling it Bug Martini. Who brought this one to our attention?
I found this one in my travels as well. I regularly read Bug, so saw on the blog post the other day Adam announcing the name change from Bug to Bug Martini. Mm-hmm. He goes on to say that although he likes the name Bug, he just started to find that was a little bit more difficult to use for his comics branding purposes than that.
Right. Can't really copyright that.
So generic.
Yep.
Whereas Bug Martini gives a bit more of a non sequitur that can connect a little bit better on the Google web rank and so forth. So it's a good sign, I guess, because if you know you're getting Jackie a comic, you don't really put that much thought into changing its name around. So for people who like Bug, it's a good thing. It's going to hopefully lead into him getting on some more merchandising now too, because apparently that's what was holding him up.
Yeah, that's
that's a very important thing. Is once you want to get to that next level, you do have to think of the whole thing as more of a brand.
Right, right. That's why, like I say, the sci-fi channel changed its name to the Sci-Fi channel.
Sci-Fi.
Because you can't like copyright sci-fi, really. I mean, it's such a general term.
And we've all seen how popular a move that was.
And now it's come and gone, and it's like, yeah, okay, it's the Sci-Fi network, it's whatever. I think, did we lose Ben?
No, I'm still here.
Oh, there you are. Yeah, that's whenever I do panels at conventions about getting people, you know, people getting into the web cartooning and such, one of the first things I do mention are, you know, look around and make sure what you want isn't already in use. And I guess I never actually brought this up, but it's like, you know, make sure it's, you know, it's something that you can copyright yourself, and it's not just something so general like Space Marine, I suppose. But it's really important to separate yourself, to not get hidden by other people looking for other things other than your own, and of course to actually license and copyright your material as well is also very important. And if you just don't care, you just don't care. But you know, things like that happen.
I suppose to a certain extent, though, having a more generic name that someone might stumble upon can help you when you're in your early days trying to get eyes on the prize. But when,
I don't even think that's
someone
possible.
That's a Bug Martini now, but level of fame, it starts to it might start to hook around the curve where it starts to become more trouble than it's worth.
Well,
it's about it is when you have a title as generic as Bug, though. I mean, there is so much crap out there which has that in the name or as part of the name or random photo descriptions. People aren't going to stumble upon that by random. There's a very low probability of people just stumbling upon it because of, you know, it's titled Bug, when there's already so much crap out there that has so much more web traffic directed towards it.
Actually, I found Bug looking for a reference picture of like a ladybug or something, and I Google searched and I'm like, what's this? So it can't be the only one.
Well, Bug also had
my experience with the web has always been all search terms lead to porn. So I'm surprised, like, you know, you didn't get bug fetish porn or something.
Putting in ladybug probably is a dangerous term with safe search off.
Bug rule 34.
Oh,
okay, Fess.
There's something listed. Oh, text only.
There's rule 34 for everything.
Oh, if not, there will be. Let's move on. Apparently, DC is trying to get its hands into the digital comic offerings once again, but it has nothing to do with giving people what they want. Instead, they're trying something that nobody's asked for. And it's DC Squared and DC Squared Multiverse, interactive and choose your own adventure experience, respectively, though they aren't actually live yet. I saw this link on Comics Alliance, which was also quoted in Variety and Wired. So they don't actually have things up yet, but I don't know if it even, I don't think this is going to hit the ground running very well.
This is a bad idea. It's because part of it is you know, the choose your own adventure thing. I don't even know how they're even going to try to get that to work where everyone will be satisfied with it, and they won't be. but not to mention, you know, the whole motion comic thing. I mean, Marvel tried motion comics a couple of years ago, and they all sucked. It looks like Clutch Cargo. It's just bad.
Yeah, you were
Google it.
Yeah, you were talking about that before the show. I'll see to that a bit of that it gets in on the pre-show. I don't know. Choose your own adventure. It can work, but it's probably, you know, it's like, you know, they're going to tell us what we want to do. And there was an Adventure Time Choose Your Own Adventure comic that came out like within the last few weeks, I think. And I didn't actually read the whole thing. I just kind of thumbed through it. But some of them kind of like it was interesting how they set up a Choose Your Own Adventure within the same comic panels and everything. And, you know, big giant arrows flowing about. It was an interesting looking experiment. And I'm pretty sure it was most likely a one off sort of joke thing. But
was it the traditional style, keep a thumb in the page where you flick forward just in case you fall down a mineshaft and go flick back and pretend it never happened?
There were choices on the same page as the solutions were. They just had arrows flying all over the place across the pages. So it's like you could like see everything right away. So it's like interesting, but I don't know. I can't.
Well, that sort of thing might lend itself better to digital.
What was that, Monty?
Oh, it's just, I mean, when was the Choose Your Adventure? When did that first break in the U.S.? When was that a big thing? Was that the 80s or?
I know it was big in the mid to late 80s for me anyway. That's when I was like getting into Choose Your Own Adventure books in you know, first, second, third grade.
Yeah, the thing about it is just when you're doing that kind of writing is that you have a less clearly defined story because you have to give the reader options. But the problem is that, you know, when you're giving the reader options, you know, they can always come up with their own options or other things they'd like to see or other things they'd like to do. And it's just, it's also the fact that, you know, whatever happens to the story, it may or may not make sense. The whole thing about Choose Your Own Adventure is that it doesn't allow you to establish as cohesive a reality as if you're just telling your own story. And so I just don't think the format, you know, is ever going to be that popular, aside from with small children who don't really have much in the way of expectations for work.
I mean, can you imagine
Choose Your Own Adventure Game of Thrones?
Yeah, I have to agree here. This is just another experiment because, you know, it's the whole, the web's interactive. We got to do something that's interactive because it's the web. And,
right. And
there's no much else, no other thought put to other than interactive and comic and motion and
we haven't actually seen it yet. I mean, I'm not going to fault somebody for trying something new, but you can fault for if you look at the execution and there's just so many obvious mistakes, you know. But I'm not going to fault a company for trying something different, not automatically anyway.
It might work out all right on the digital platform because if you were saying, for example, the Adventure Time one, you could see all the other endings and that on the same page. I mean, I suppose that a digital swipe through system will sort of help that from getting in the way of the experience.
Right.
And it might give the same thing a bit of rereadability as well because you could sort of go back and try going through a different path and etc. I can see the value to that, but it all depends whether it's pulled off properly.
I mean, I can kind of see it maybe working more so if they're specifically going for like a younger audience, like if DC wants to use like their kids version of the DC universe. I could see that kind of working like that if it's marketed like that. Or if you take, or could even work if you look at something like Arkham Asylum style, where it almost anything could possibly go.
Well, they sort of say that they're going to release it in conjunction with the new Arkham Batman video game, don't they?
Oh, okay.
Arkham Origins.
So it seems to be sort of what they're looking at. I don't know how kid friendly that'll be.
Yeah, probably not. What's that, Mommy? That's a spine, dear.
And the thing about it is if they're trying to actually release it at the same time with Arkham Origins, that means they're probably going to be rushing it to meet the deadline so they can maximize their sales. So they might maximize their sales that way, but they won't, you know, it's probably not. I mean, I'm not big into the second-person perspective, But I'm just thinking because they're going to rush it, it's not going to be as good as it otherwise might be.
Right.
Is it even going to... I mean, would it be a second-person perspective thing, or would it be sort of a...
Yeah, you mean
third Joker goes in the building, do you want to see what the Joker does, or do you want to see what Batman's doing on the roof type of choose-your-own-adventure?
Yeah, that'd be like a faux choose-your-own-adventure, because it's just like... If you're not just actually deciding,
stories what, you can flip between.
Yeah, I mean,
I could see that working out better though.
Yeah, I could. It's like following somebody. It's one thing I really like. Hey, has anyone here seen the movie Go? Okay, there's this movie that came out, I think, in the early 2000s or the late 90s. It was called Go, and essentially, you kind of think Pulp Fiction in such a way where it kind of follows other people's things, other people's plotting through they're walking through the plot of the movie, but you see everyone else. Go is kind of like that too, though it's not mishmashed together. It's like there's like four stories, and it's completely one story is front to end, and they're all in different places at the different time, and I really like that. It's not a choose your own adventure, but I really like that seeing the story from a different perspective. It's just this person over here, that person over there, or it's like, what was it like on that end? It's like, how did they interpret? And there's been movies where this, like, especially like in like court cases, there was also a Kurosawa movie where they were like recanting something that happened, and they were telling everyone was telling the story differently. Now that was interesting. I like storytelling like that, but a true choose your own adventure, especially for like say the core audience of comic book readers, I'll wait and see, but it's kind of hard.
Unless it's a kid's thing, I just don't see that thing work. I just don't see a choose your own adventure thing working out too well.
Because how are they going to publish issue by issue by issue? Unless they have it set to where all the choices you make are so minuscule to the plot that they can just pretty much do the same. They could do the same next issue for everyone.
That, or they're all self-contained. I can see it if it's a self-contained story, which isn't necessarily bad, or a sequel maybe coming up if a particular one is really, really popular, or a particular ending is really popular, and then people go from one particular... there's options. There's possibilities. I'm not going to discount it just yet. Let's wait till it comes out, then we'll criticize it.
Does anyone know if there's been a webcomic analog done of this? It seems like something that someone must have tried already.
People have tried webcomic choose your own adventures, and it's usually like it's a live thing though, or it's as it happens.
I've seen people do Flash ones, and those always try to force you down one path no matter what.
Right. Otherwise, they're done as it's created. So it's kind of like what happens next is group decided, more or less.
So it's sort of more of a Homestuck sort of style.
Well, MS Paint Adventures more so, I would say.
Well, actually, Miss Dynamite tried that when it started out.
Hmm.
And it was kind of not good.
Yeah, they're all kind of not good.
Let's see what DC can do with it then.
Yeah, let's see what DC can do with it. All right, we're going to take our first break, and we'll be right back.
This program is part of the Webcast Beacon Network at webcastbeacon.com. You can find and follow us on Tumblr, Facebook, Google+, and Twitter. Just search for Webcast Beacon. Have thoughts or questions on an episode? You can leave us a voicemail at 1-320-310-0922 or email us at webcomicbeacon@gmail.com. The Webcast Beacon Network, covering and promoting creativity in the creative process since 2007. Comics, art, and writing discussions, interviews, news, and reviews. At webcastbeacon.com.
Now, back to our show.
And we're back.
There we are.
That was I feel great. Refreshed and rejuvenated after our break.
Not really. Let's take a look here. The next couple of items we got are on editorial comics in newspapers. What are newspapers, you may ask? Well, whatever. You know what they are. We're just kidding. So if anybody who doesn't know who Sean Delonis is, he worked for the New York Post for about 23 years and accepted a buyout to leave the paper. On the Daily Cartoonist, I saw this. The very first comment was like, good riddance. And then I started taking a look more. It's like, oh, this is the guy who drew President Obama as a chimp getting shot by police. So.
And why can't he do that?
Without going into the obvious, you don't get it, Ben.
But you can't just
there's
say,
there's something
oh,
particular wrong with drawing a black person as an ape, Ben.
There's a very long history behind
but it. People, but people have, but the thing is, people
it's
have,
like drawing people, a black person.
Let me finish my sentence right. fast before you interrupt me, please.
All right.
People were drawing George W. Bush as an ape all the time as a chimp.
Mm-hmm.
So you're saying that black people have special protection from being drawn as a chimp, even though, like I said, George W. Bush was drawn as a chimp, Obama was drawn as a chimp, and oh no, it's you know what?
No, I get it, Ben. I do get it, but it's not like it's some absolute sacred thing. But you have to back up and understand that referring and drawing black people as primitive apes is kind of disparative. And it's been long well to disparage.
Let me put this way. I think this is the longest has been the time that sensitivity has become correct. Political correctness has become censorship. I think everyone's free to do whatever they want to do, and
you can't pretend people, there's nothing wrong with that though. That's part of the problem.
I'd be with you on this, but the thing of the matter is that, you know, there are still little old grandmas who, you know, lived back during Jim Crow days and are still afraid of those things returning. And so
I
understand why those kinds of people are still hypersensitive to this kind of thing.
Well, you know what? It's I'm not, and I'm going to tell you why. Because the oldest black person alive is how many generations from slavery?
Well, let's see. 1860s, 150 years. So, I mean, how long do you want to call
it's
a generation?
Two generations.
No, it's more than two.
Well, that's two lives.
It's 150 years. Oh, two lives.
A generation is would be about 20 years. If you go like that, but the point is, I mean, I thought the same
point.
Thing, Ben. I did think the same thing when
even
I first
then,
heard
about.
It's not
like
this.
The 1960s happened and boom, everybody got their civil rights.
Let me put it this way. I'm half Korean.
Mm-hmm.
The Korean people were in slavery in 1940
mm-hmm.
by the Japanese,
mm-hmm.
and you know what? We got over it. There, I said it.
Is that everybody?
But that's you. You know, that's you, Ben. And I will point out that everybody on the show right now is not black. So
yeah, and it's yeah. And there's this recently came up in Australian media too, as well, where one of our very prominent media figures made a comment that an Aboriginal footballer should have got involved with King Kong because he looks just as much like a chimp, blah, blah, blah sort of thing. And, you know, the big deal is that for the people that you're talking about, you know, a lot of them still get offended by this sort of thing. It's very hard as someone who doesn't have to deal with a great amount of racism in any given day to start sort of poking their head up and saying, well, it's not really a problem.
They're just words.
Well, not
they're just words. They're just words. And
but words can hurt.
Words
can hurt, but at the same time, they are just words. And I'm against censorship. I'm against censorship of any kind. And the thing, like I said, the thing is people said the most horrible things about George W. Bush being a chimp, a monkey. You know, they said, look at his face next to a chimp. He looks like a monkey. The people said that about George W. Bush, and he's a white guy, so it's okay to call him a monkey. And but you say that about a black person, all of a sudden it's off limits, off limits.
All right, let's get Monty in here. Let's get Monty in here.
Brutalize them, but anyway, getting off topic.
George W. Bush were without particular consequence. I've experienced some token racism in my life, and it really hasn't affected my life too greatly. It's just kind of a momentary, what's going on here? But right now I live by an elderly black couple, and yesterday the guy just got frisked for drugs. And he wasn't too happy about it. And so it's just, it's kind of, you know, I mean, the thing about it is that, you know, racism for black people had a very strong hint of menace and very severe consequences for a prolonged period of time. And you still have people who have lived through it at its worst. And it, like I said, it's not like the 1960s happened and everything was fixed.
Right.
We're going through a slow transition to a post-racial society, but we're sure as hell not there yet.
Well, that's true, but part of it is part of the way to get there is two things. And one of those two things is you have to stop, you know, reacting to everything. If someone does one thing that's untoward, you don't publicly ask for his head just because.
Well, no, I mean,
because that's what happened. Because that's what always happens is if someone says anything, like a good example is this. Who here has read Br'er Rabbit?
Br'er Rabbit? I might have. I don't remember. If I did, it was when I was a kid. And I remember
Br'er Rabbit.
Okay. In Br'er Rabbit, there was a story about how the villain of the story, I forgot who it was, I believe it was the fox, attempted to capture Br'er Rabbit by building a baby out of tar.
Little black baby.
A baby out of tar, and Br'er Rabbit passed by the tar baby and said hi, and the tar baby, of course, being out of tar, said nothing, so Br'er Rabbit wrestled with the tar baby and got stuck in tar.
Oh, shit, I remember that now.
And what happened was anyone who read Br'er Rabbit read the story about the tar baby, and if anyone says, I'm not going to wrestle with that tar baby, all of a sudden people got offended and called for people's heads in the media. And it's like, haven't you read Br'er Rabbit?
Here's the thing. It's like, there's one thing to say something offhand or do something and not think about it. There's a different thing if somebody has a particular history of being sort of a hateful, spiteful, bigoted person, of which this guy is. He's completely a bigoted asshole. And so it's not like just some sort of, oh, the president's an ape sort of thing. I mean, granted, if you go back to George W. Bush, the screenshots and the comparisons to actual apes were, you couldn't tell who was who, honestly. I mean, really. Except one was wearing a suit. Well, then again, monkeys can wear a suit. Anyway, the point is like I have more of a problem.
So you see, you're allowed to be disrespectful to a white person, but not to a black person. So now they're a protected status.
Class. George W. Bush was a complete asshole, but that's besides the point. And I haven't been happy with any presidential candidate completely in the past ever since I could vote. So whatever. But when you have somebody who has a history of being a bigot, that's where I start having a problem because it's their words, Ben. You're very thick skinned, Ben, and that's fine. But it still doesn't discount somebody for being a hateful asshole like this guy or anybody that's trying to provoke, trying to insult, trying to degrade, trying to put in their place is uncalled for regardless. Granted, there's slips of the tongue or just sort of like casual stuff, which I wouldn't put as much stake. But if you're being an active racist, if you're actively being a bigot, I have a huge problem with that.
Let them be a bigot. Then you know who they are. Well, by trying to censor them or punish them or push them in the corners, you don't know who the bigots are anymore. If you let everyone say whatever they want to say, all of a sudden, you know who all the bigots are.
The thing about it is that just by letting bigotry go unopposed, though, is that it does reinforce cultural norms.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so, I mean, it's just, you know, for the longest time, our society is still kind of racist, but it's becoming less so. Our society has been severely homophobic, but it's just because people have spoken out and resisted that, you know, homosexuals are becoming more accepted. And so, I mean, that's the thing is that, you know, if you just... The thing about it is that these people aren't on the same playing field. I've personally done editorial cartoons. And so I understand when you're writing editorial cartoons, being offending people is your greatest weapon. It's just kind of who are you offending and why? Because it's just, yeah. You know, if you're kicking around, you know, homosexuals or you're kicking around some minority group or something, it...
Well, insult's an insult. That's the biggest thing I'm trying to say. An insult is an insult.
Well, there's an insult, and then there's disparity.
No. There's an insult is an insult. That's the thing. You're trying to give insults special classes so you can create special protected ethnic groups by doing this, by saying, oh, you can't say this joke because it goes against this ethnic group. All of a sudden, you're creating protected classes when you do that.
There's insults, and then there's insults with consequence.
Yeah, it's freedom. We may have freedom of speech. It's not freedom from consequence from speech.
What kind of consequence can there be? You can be fired if your boss doesn't like it. I understand that. But at the same time, what beyond that? Because anything beyond that is censorship.
Well, I mean, for the longest time, all this humor, though, was used to reinforce their inferiority and deny people legal rights.
Yeah, that's a huge difference.
Touchy thing.
That's a huge difference, Ben.
How long ago was this offensive cartoon posted compared to now in taking the buyout and leaving the newspaper for Sean DeLay?
It could have not been. It was
2009.
Dealt with the stimulus. When was it? Sorry for interrupting.
The link I have here is from 2009.
2009?
Okay. So it's not like it's really sort of
something
faded
done
to it
back in the 1980s when it was okay.
And it wasn't like it was like a caricature. I think it was actually a chimpanzee. I mean, it's like you can do funny characters, and almost any time you draw a political person as a character, they kind of look like a monkey, to be fair. But aside from that, I think we should probably move on. Somebody did bring this up. Oops. Who brought up the Bill Day, apparently?
I did.
You did.
Okay, the story is basically is that the editorial cartoonist Bill Day had been he'd been discharged from his newspaper, as most editorial cartoonists have over the last decade. But what happened is he started an Indiegogo campaign to try and fund his career so he could go on for another year. And what ended up happening is that first there was this minor incident of plagiarism where he found the drawing of a gun online, and he incorporated that into a cartoon. And, you know, there was somebody noticed that he'd copied this image. And so, you know, there was a little bit of a minor here over that, but he drew his own gun and fixed that up. But it's just then some people started plumbing through his work and going through it. And if you look at the archives, he reuses a lot of cartoons, and by reuse, I mean reuse. He'll like maybe change a single word. Sometimes he doesn't change anything at all. And so you have there's a Tumblr account called That Cartoon Critic, which the person doing it documented found incidents of Bill Day's self-plagiarism. And it's literally over a year's worth of work. And this is just what the guys found. And I mean, the thing about it is he also stopped a while ago. And, when the story broke is that a lot of editorial cartoonists were actually speaking out in favor of Bill Day, just talking about how they have to work with tight deadlines. And Mr. Day himself, since he's laid off, he was working in a, I'm not sure if it was a bicycle shop or he was working in a warehouse or a factory, But, I mean, he had the second job, and it was consuming all his time, quite a good deal of his time, and so they're, you know, using that as validation. But the thing about it is, for him, cutting corners. But the thing about it is, if you go back in his work, this practice had been long established, even when he was working in a newspaper.
I don't really have a big problem with the self-plagiarism. I think it's, I mean, if you can reuse an existing work, if you can, in the general sense of the word, to prove a point, or if it still works or is still valid, I don't have a big problem with that, especially when it comes to, or especially when it came to, like, newspapers where you really had, you didn't, like, collect newspapers and you could, like, check them out. They weren't collected, so it wasn't, like...
So it's fine when you're not going to get caught.
Well, yeah.
I'm always against this sort of thing because I think it's the epitome of laziness.
It is. It's lazy. Don't get me wrong, Ben. I'm just saying it's self-plagiarism. I mean, if you want to whatever.
Well, it's not only self-plagiarism. It just you know, stares me right in the face and says, you know, I'm a lazy artist. A good example of this is, you know, in comic books, artists do this all the time. Like, and when they do it like a couple of times, you know, between five issues, there's like a couple of panels or a couple of poses used the same in five issues. That's one thing. But a good example of this is Mike McCone did this, and it was really obvious because it was like a six panel page once. I remember this. He did a six panel page where it was basically just the same panel. He drew like a really large panel of two characters talking, sitting in a library, and then all the other little panels are just different. Like, he went into Photoshop and took the crop tool, just did different crops and moved those to be the top five panels. It's like it's that kind of laziness that's like, gee, you didn't even want to do anything here. When cartoonists do this, cartoonists are supposed to be prided by being able to create something new every day.
Well, that's awfully specific, but prided to do something new, I would say. Maybe not necessarily every day, but yeah.
But especially when we're talking about editorial cartoonists, people who are expected to say something that's supposed to be hot on the issue.
And relevant, yeah. Yeah, okay, I see what you're saying now. Yeah.
It's even worse because it's like, so what you're saying is nothing is relevant. You can just use the same old tired political jokes and just change the caption. And all of a sudden, it's relevant again. That's number one, that's halfway true. But number two, that's not what you're paid to do.
Exactly. That's, I mean, it's kind of like you're cheating your employer at that point for sure.
It actually is cheating your employer. It's a good example of this is artists are charged per, you know, in comics, artists are charged per page, and I imagine that in comic strips, they're charged per strip.
Right.
And the going rate now for professional comic page is about the $150-$200, I believe, and I imagine strips are somewhat competitive around there, and with comic strips, you know, same with comic books. If you're drawing a comic book and you reuse a page, you don't get charged that page because you already drew that page. And this really does happen. You don't get the money for that page if you use that page before. So here he actually is actively defrauding his employers by doing this.
There is that element to it. I suppose for me, I'm looking at this at an audience standpoint. And the thing about it is that, okay, maybe you can ethically justify it. But it's just in terms of the audience, people get bored of seeing the same things over and over again. And they may not realize it's the same thing, but, you know, there's going to be a familiarness to it, and it just causes the reader to disengage.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, I guess, that's in my opinion, a problem that editorial cartooning's been having, is just that, you know, most of the cartoonists are so much alike in terms of drawing, in terms of execution, in terms of humor, that people just gotten bored reading them. And so it's just when these newspaper cartoonists get fired, nobody cares. or at least not too many people. They don't. There's not an audience for their work once they're not kicked off the newspaper.
Right.
I mean, how many successful cartoonists are there out on the internet? I mean, Matt Bors is kind of building a career for himself, but he's partially in the world of indie papers, though. I mean, that's mostly drying up. You have Mark Fiore. I mean, how many other successful editorial cartoonists are actually out there making a living online?
Not too many.
Let's repose this into webcomics. How many comics out there that are copy paste? I mean, I'm not necessarily saying direct copy paste from one panel to the next. I mean, where it's this, they're reusing a model, and they're maybe adding an arm or moving an arm, changing the facial expressions, but it's basically the exact same model. How many people are actually getting away with that and being successful? I know of maybe one off the top of my head that is, I think, moderately successful anyway.
Has any, I'd open a can of worms, has anyone seen PvP in the last few months? There seems to be an awful lot of cut and paste from same strip to the next, from same panel to the next.
Yeah.
That is true. It's, and like I said, that to me is that laziness. And,
yeah.
And I mean, part of my mindset is if you're working for yourself and you're really that lazy and your audience doesn't mind, whatever. Right. But like I said, that, you know, I know what it's like out there. If you reuse art and your editor can prove it, you don't get money for your page, and that's exactly how it's built. That's right. Exactly how that system's built. It's the same here. It's the same everywhere in the world. A good example of this is Akira Toriyama actually copy pasted the two pages in his Dragon Ball manga, and he actually wrote a note in the page, editor, you don't have to charge me for these pages.
Oh, really?
Yes, he did.
That's kind of cool. No,
he's donating it.
Thinking about like some web comics here, and there, or it's like I can understand if like if you crank out like a lot of different projects. I like Scott Johnson from Extra Life. I know that he's done some copy paste where it's like a static shot, and then the next shot, the mouth may change, or there's a hand up. He's also creates a whole lot of other different content constantly. So it's not like Bill Day, where it's almost like every other thing is something that he's ripping off. I mean, he doesn't go back into his archives and reuse stuff. I mean, it's a matter of a quickness sort of thing, but it doesn't impress me that he doesn't redraw a character though. So,
like I said, I find people who try to do Gagadays always fall back to that quicker than other people. Mm-hmm. For example, this is David Willis did this once. I remember he drew this one page where it was like Kermit and Miss Piggy having dinner, and he literally only drew one page and just changed the mouth flap. and it was the laziest thing ever, and the joke wasn't even very good, but it's David Willis, so that's pretty much obvious. So
I know we have probably a big difference of opinion with when it comes to Dave Willis, but I think we have some common ground as well, but that's kind of why I have you on the show, Ben. We have differing opinions, and I think it's good.
Well, it's good you don't want to live in an echo chamber.
No, that's why I always have to have somebody else on the show.
But like I said, I've seen Gagadays always go back to this, because Gagadays, you know, always seem to go back to it's two people talking to each other, and it's really tempting and really seductive, the idea of I just have two heads.
Mm-hmm. Well,
it's when you have two people talking, and when the joke's mostly in the dialogue, a lot of people, they just ignore, you know, trying to enhance the joke through physical expression of the characters. They try to ignore doing setups with the characters or the environments. They just, you know, the characters. I mean, the artwork's secondary to just getting the dialogue and the bubbles.
Yeah, that's true.
But the thing is, with the if they did the two people talking and did something a little bit more interesting visually, they'd have something.
Yeah, I agree with you that, Ben. But you know, it's like with all the web comics out there.
And then I put a link in the chat.
Okay. Mm-hmm. I mean, if the writing is good, you know, and the art is bad, even if it is, I mean, you can still have an all right comic or a funny comic if the writing is still really good, or the writing is really if the writing really carries your whole comic though, and nobody really cares about the art, maybe you're fine. Maybe you should look into somebody else that could put a little more dynamism, if that's the word, into your comic. But sometimes it's not needed as much. It's like, maybe
sometimes with Gaga Days, you have people talking about really weird stuff that would... A good example of this, going back to David Willis, was... was David Willis once did a comic where he had two people talking about Annie and how it relates to Captain America, I think. And the conversation went to somewhere weird about Daddy Warbucks throwing someone in the sun or something like that. But the point is, that's an interesting visual, but the comic was still just two people talking to each other, right, versus him drawing that. And I actually made this argument to someone saying, you know, it would be like this was around the time when Kevin Smith was kicked off of an airplane for being
too fat
for one seat.
Yeah.
So as people know, Kevin Smith was also in and directed Dogma. Mm-hmm. And in Dogma was a scene where Silent Bob kicked out one of the bad guys off a bus or a train, and he said, no ticket.
Yeah.
He said, no ticket. And I said, it would be like doing two different strips, one where you have two people talking about the Kevin Smith getting kicked off of a plane thing and saying how similar it was to that Dogma scene. Another doing it where a stewardess does that to Kevin Smith and then does no ticket.
Yeah, I agree with you on that.
Because two people talking about a visual gag, it's just talking heads about a visual gag is one thing, and then another. You're in a comic, draw it already. Yeah,
you're talking about show don't tell.
Yes.
I think
show
we should
it, don't say it.
Yeah, I think we should move on to the next one. Somebody, are we done with Bill Day and Sean Delonis? All right. Somebody posted a link to an interview with Stevenson and Crescetto.
Yes, I did. Basically, what it was is just that they were specifically being interviewed for their experience as being well, if I can just fire up the link here, let's see. But I mean, they're just being experienced. They were being interviewed over their experience
and we lost them.
Women and cartoonists. But there it is, back up again.
Yeah,
I mean, it covers much. It's much wider about that. I mean, a lot of the articles just about them being generic. You know, I mean, the generic experience of being a cartoonist, but it covers a wide variety of things.
Could they be the next people that are interviewed by every single media outlet out there? It's been a while since we've had that happen. Eric Kimball's not here anymore, so he can't. We can't give him crap for that. But now that's an old joke if you want to reach back a year in the archives. Yeah, we're basically down to some follow-up articles that we've had. We talked about Google Wallet last year. Last episode. And an article in GigaOM basically is like, as much as money as they've been putting behind Google Wallet, it's just not catching on. People don't seem to care. And I think that has a little bit of a reflection of the execution. I mean, it's there, but it's not what people want. And what people want, at least, I guess, from you know, a lot of creators' standpoint, for people that want to sell stuff, it's not what they want. People want a PayPal competitor. And that could be a reason why that nobody really cares. It could be. What do you think, Ben, since I know you're a huge Google user?
I think Google Wallet works good for what it's supposed to do, because number one, it's a way to pay for other things on the internet. It's also a way to do wireless payment in the real world. It's like I said, I always use it all the time. Whenever I go to a McDonald's or a CVS, Google Wallet is more than just PayPal, in that it's not only sending money through the internet, it's also spending money mm-hmm. with wireless devices. So in that regard, it has Square and PayPal beat, because right now they want to use these awful looking giant ass dongles to plug into the audio jack of your phone.
Oh, come on, Ben. Square is brilliant.
It's
8 billion in transactions.
My phone can do the same thing without an awful looking dongle by just tapping another phone.
No, Ben. It is. You tried. It's while there's some merit to that, Ben. U.S. is not there for adaptation. So having a little tiny dongle sticking out of your phone to be able to take
it's about 1.5 inch by 1.5 inch size square. It is
an inch or less square, Ben. Anyway, the point is that when you're at like a comic show and you're selling stuff at your table and somebody doesn't have enough cash, they have a credit card. What they don't have is probably some app loaded onto their data phone, if they have a data phone, or even if
who doesn't have a data phone?
Lots of people don't have a data phone.
I don't.
The adaptation is just not there yet, Ben. That's the problem. And that's the problem with this, with how many hundreds of millions Google spent trying to promote Google Wallet, and they're still not really showing anything for that extra money that they spent. The adaptation is just not there, or they're not offering something in such a way that people want to adopt Google Wallet yet.
The problem is Google is just recently going to offer send cash through an email. That wasn't a part of the equation when they did this study. It already lost because we're comparing it to a feature that it doesn't even have yet.
Okay.
And Google Wallet initially was a wireless payment system. That's what it originally is. For $500 million in 1 year as a wireless payment system in the U.S. Mm-hmm. that doesn't have broad adoption, that's actually pretty damn good. That's $500 million off of just about five handsets that offer NFC back in last year. So I'm not seeing a failure.
Right. Well, right. But you got Square that works with it with any data phone.
I know, but Square, can you pay money to someone else with a Square on your phone?
What do you mean? Yeah, I got a credit card and I slide my...
Well, let's say you are at a Starbucks and you want to pay for whatever.
I pull out my credit.
Can you do that with a Square?
Not a Starbucks. But okay, here's the other thing, Ben. I'm not avoiding your question. Maybe not a Starbucks, but maybe a different local coffee shop that has an iPad or a smartphone with a Square plugged into it.
No, not you. Not them have a Square. You have a Square. Can you use Square to pay someone else money?
As a customer, no, I can't use a Square.
Then that's the difference. Google Wallet sends money. Square receives money. They're completely different.
But Ben, so does PayPal.
PayPal doesn't send money.
Yeah, I send money. I can send money. I just paid for a career counselor with PayPal last week.
But did you do it in the office by tapping your phone somewhere or using the PayPal dongle on the phone?
She didn't have a phone. I just opened up my PayPal app and I typed in her email address. Otherwise, she was going to do it through her laptop. The point is that also, aside from this, which, Ben, it's fine. Google Wallet is great in theory, but the adoption is just not there yet, and that's fine. It'll be interesting to see where the future takes us. I'm not saying it's a terrible idea. One thing, it'll be great.
It'll be really great when they integrate it with Google Glass, so you can just swipe your face across stuff.
But the thing, what I love more about Square as far as like a way to option the payment is that, especially when you go to some local venue, which, you know, of how much those little devices that most people, you know, they slide their card through, Square is 50% or less than the fees that they have to pay for it. So it makes it a little bit easier for those small businesses. Granted, if they had also like a, you know, you bump your phone to their iPad sort of thing with maybe the PayPal app or something like that, but Square is there and it's not going away. That dongle helps these smaller businesses a hell of a lot, as well as independent creators. Now, we're not there yet with the phone tapping yet. It's not like Japan, However, it was really interesting. It looks like this is related. I don't have a link for it, but I saw this earlier on thing All Things D, I think. There is, I think, a Japanese phone company that's trying to buy Sprint.
Yes.
Which is sounds really interesting, because if that happens, I would like to see a little bit more of that Japanese phone, every fucking thing that they have their pace pick up in America, because we're really lagging behind data phones in the rest of the world, I think. Is that true?
Yeah, we are. But at the same time, I look at like this. And the problem isn't that anymore, because all of Samsung's phones released in the United States in the last 2 years had NFC built in. Same with HTC's phones. It's a
all right. I think you need to explain.
And Motorola's
that.
The NFC is built in already. The problem is the retailers.
Okay, Ben. I think you need to back up and explain the
near field communication. Basically, okay. The idea is it's a low power chip in certain phones. Like I said, last year Samsung released phones. This year Samsung released phones. This year HTC released phones. Okay. Motorola. Pretty much everyone that's not an iPhone in the last year has an NFC chip in it, and the next iPhone won't have it either because it has aluminum back.
Okay.
An NFC chip is basically a near field communication chip, where basically it's a low power chip that actually can also be partially powered by another NFC receiver nearby. Mm-hmm. So there's lots of credit cards that have that NFC symbol on it. So a piece of plastic has that chip embedded in it, where you tap it, it has all your credit card information in it. It's read by the reader. Boom, you go. With Google Wallet and other NFC payment systems, the idea is very similar, where you have the NFC chip in there, and once you unlock your wallet app, whatever that may be, it says, "Okay, I'm ready to hit a receiver." You hit a receiver, the chip powers up and says, "Okay, here's the credit card information for this transaction." That passes through. So it's basically contactless payment.
Mm-hmm. I'd worry about security with that a little bit, though.
Like I said, with wallet applications, you have to unlock the wallet for the chip to get the data.
Well, right, but like if your phone got stolen, or I guess if you had an embedded card that got stolen, I mean, is there any sort of like sign or verification? You know, it's like any sort of thing like that.
The cards that had it didn't have anything, because the cards were just cards. You probably have or had in the last 5 years a debit card that had NFC built in. Like I said, just turn it over, and you should see either PayPass or a symbol of three radiating. You know, three radiating lines curved, going to the right.
And with this, basically, also, if two people have phones that are like this, and of course an appropriately downloaded app, because they're likely not embedded to quickly, because you'd have to like sign in with Google Wallet or whatever that would use that. Then two people can just swap money via phone. Is also what you're saying.
Yes, and you can also swap other things too. Like, let's say I'm on a website I find interesting. I have NFC on my phone. And if you have NFC on your phone, like if I'm reading an article on a website, I tap my phone to yours and it can share the website to your phone.
They have that now with Bump and stuff anyway.
I thought those Bump apps were just kind of dumb fun. It's like
No. NFC is better than Bump, because Bump requires active GPS, location, accelerometer, data, and other things, while NFC is just powering just one chip versus three.
So Bump was working the way I thought it was working. But
Bump, like I said, requires powering three chips. NFC requires powering one, and an NFC chip is so low power compared to the other two.
Okay.
Not to mention it's precise. Let's say you have two people bumping. You have two sets of people bumping. Four people bumping their phones.
Like, this is a wild time, Ben.
Hold on. You have four people in two groups that are 5 feet apart, and they're both using Bump on their phones. Well, the problem with that is the GPS might not get it correctly, because it might say, "Oh, you're bumping with the guy across the room, not the guy that's next to you," because the GPS location might be slightly off. That's why Bump is less secure than NFC.
And I do got to tell you, there's nothing more awkward than being in a room with a lot of people and end up bumping the wrong person. It's just really awkward.
I thought you were in an open relationship, Fess.
I didn't say it. I said it'd be, it's really awkward, Ben, if you're in a room with multiple people, especially if it's dark, and you end up bumping the wrong person. That's all I'm saying. So anyway, you just get it.
Very nice.
All right, so we just got a little bit of time here left for a couple of other follow-up articles, as sort of related and unrelated that was. I thought it was really good information, and I thank Ben for being knowledgeable in the ways of Google and Wallet. Last bit of news, a couple of things. Comics Alliance is back. Okay.
Yay!
We talked about that that AOL shut them down. Apparently they're back. I don't know what happened with that. Does anybody know what actually happened with that? Because there just seemed to be...
It doesn't seem to be anything on the website, eh? It's just...
They're just...
There again.
There. They're back. And that's it. But,
Here we go. We got another aggregator. Hooray!
All right. So, and then there was like this last thing. Now, Ben, you were talking about this earlier. We mentioned a while ago that somebody was going around suing podcasters, essentially. And so what happened with that, Ben?
Well, here's a guy. The whole story about this guy was in the 90s, in the early 90s. He had the idea of basically reading magazine articles or having them read and being shipped via cassette tape to people who subscribe. And he basically had the bright idea in like 1996 to write this as a patent for a digital version of this by, you know, basically saying he's patenting a method to transfer audio information from one computer to another based on subscription. And this overly broad patent is referred to as the podcasting patent, and unlike other people who like sue people who like hold all the podcast subscriptions, like say Apple and iTunes, now he's going after like the people that are podcasting. He's going after the end user of podcasting,
right?
And saying,
as in the listener.
Well, he's anyone with a microphone that puts an MP3 online is essentially breaking this patent.
Oh, he's going after people without the resources to get a lawyer. Essentially,
he's doing the Prenda lawsuit thing where he's casting a wide net and hoping to get small $5,000 chunks.
He's actually gotten money.
Good on him.
I don't know if he's gotten money. Oh, he has?
I thought he was.
I know
do anything to avoid a lawsuit.
I know some people are taking a stand against him, like what's his name? The comedian that I forgot the comedian's name, but this comedian has a podcast, and I forgot his name, but the only thing I know about him was this awesome joke he told where he was on like the Tonight Show with Queen Latifah, because what he did was the joke was he had this whole bit about the blister packs on toys being impossible to open.
Mm-hmm.
And what he did, and before he was on, Queen Latifah was on there talking about her trip to Jamaica, saying everyone was saying everything's Lyman as awesome, and this comedian, he didn't know that. So he showed up and he was doing this whole shtick about the blister packs, the toys being hard to open. And he said, you need a line man dig, a diagonal cutter, to cut through this. But he said it so fast. So it sounded like he said Lyman dike.
Lyman.
And so he says, so basically he said that. And then he passed the toy, the package off to Queen Latifah to say, here, you open this.
Oh, no.
So anyways, getting back to the topic.
Anyway, webcomics, actually that is it. Actually was there is he been called out? Is he no more, or what happened with him?
Lawsuits are going forward, and people are ready to fight him.
Well, good. Sounds like an asshole.
So they should. Lord.
All right.
I wonder, though, I mean, how do you kill a patent troll? Does it require acid or fire to really finish him off, or
I mean, it requires a nuclear bomb in Cupertino.
All right, and with the with the government hearing that, Ben will probably not be here next time we record a show because he'll be in questioning. Yeah, that's a whole nother topic we're not going to talk about on the Webcomic Beacon. But that is it for this particular episode. Thank you all for coming in and listening. If you would like to send hate mail to Ben, I will certainly direct you to the certain spot for that. If you would like to join the conversation, you can always make a post into this episode's show post at webcomicbeacon.com. And I do want to thank, I think I want to thank Ben for coming from Animation Aficionados.
Thank you.
Monty from his DeviantArt page.
Thank you.
And Terrence from AJ Comic.
Thanks for having me again.
And I've been Fess, and this is the Webcomic Beacon. And we're done.
The Corsetto article, it's fascinating, but it's just, I don't know how to discuss it. I can't really talk about being a woman in webcomics, and having four guys talk about it just kind of seems tacky.
Yeah.
Yeah, I have plenty of experience being a woman in the world of web cartooning.
I actually couldn't think of who was the artist. It was she did, I should
Kate
know.
Beaton.
Kate Beaton. Duh, Kate Beaton.
Vagrant.
Yeah, Hark of Vagrant. I couldn't think of her name for the life of me on the show. So yeah, that's the joke I was going for earlier, and hopefully people got it.
So you guys don't remember? Never seen that episode of The Tonight Show with the Lyman Dykes thing, huh?
No,
no, I don't, and I don't have TV, so.
Can't say I did.
I know, but it, like I said, he didn't even realize what he said was "quote unquote wrong,"
right? But he didn't mean to. If it was there,
so do you actually get mail or do you get messages? Because Ben, God, there's going to be hate
Monty?
Mail in your future.
I do. I actually do. I actually do get some contacts about people complaining about Ben.
That'll be interesting to see what happens.
At least they're getting engaged.
Here and there I do. It's not like constantly, but Ben's actually done a great job of keeping things a little bit more toned down and not talking over people as much, which was usually a bigger concern that people had. And I do apologize if, Monty, we're running over you. I'm trying to be more mindful of that, too, because I've used to do that, too, so.
Well, it's just, you know, it's either you type in or you just speak out. You can't be shy and bashful about it.
Well, there's that too, but then it just sometimes just gets drowned out. So I just wanted to make sure everyone gets their piece in. So, so we got to figure out another time to record that part two for the strip search thing. The first one was really, really fun. I liked that one. And
yeah, it was good.
And I think I have noted when the next newscast is going to be. I just redid my resume, and so I'm really looking for a job, which is why I'm kind of been sort of.
You kept it underneath. You kept it under one page, right?
No, actually, I've been told by multiple sources to have more than one page. I've always had one page.
That's a bad idea.
That's not what I heard. I've heard from multiple sources that you want more than one, especially if you're looking for a government job, you want as many pages as possible, essentially.
Well, here's a question. Who's telling
a government
us?
Job, possibly.
Who's telling you this?
A professional career guidance person.
So you're paying them for as long as you don't have the job you want to help you find the job you want. And you're going to take their advice. That's the thing. It's like going to a shrink. You're paying them to help you. It's like,
No,
I could get them better in a week, or I could get them better in three years.
My dad works for the USDA, and on the curriculum vitae, they want everything that's relevant.
Right.
And by everything, I mean everything.
Right. And that's the thing. I've been hearing from multiple sources. Maybe when you're coming right out of college, yeah, one page because you really don't have that much experience. But yeah, I've been hearing from multiple sources. So I'm going to do this, give it a shot. I actually really like my new resume. So
that's why I always try to sidestep the hiring manager whenever I can and talk to the person in charge. No, it works. It really works.
I imagine it does.
Ben,
you have the social skills to pull it off.
Ben's got it all figured out.
I do actually.
You have it figured out for you, Ben.
Now, Ben, if only you could bottle that and sell that to the general public.
Sell the Ben juice.
I am.
Ben juice. All right.
I am writing a book. I am writing a book on my process of job hunting.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, there you go.
Not just the process, though. It's also the delivery. And if you're not good at making those one-on-one social connections.
The biggest thing is in graphic design, you have to find the person that you need to talk to. Number one. Number two, you have to make an impression. And it doesn't matter how skilled you are. If you can do those two things, that's 50%. And the rest of it is just, can you interview well?
All right. We just sidestepped his book. We don't have to buy it anymore.
Well, actually, there's a lot more to it than that. But the point, like I said, is...
Yeah, let me know when you come out in a question mark suit.
Well, what I did was, there was one job listing that said they were looking for someone who could wear a lot of hats.
Yeah.
I applied wearing 5 hats on my head, and I got a call back for an interview at that place.
Oh,
yeah! I heard that story. That was amazing.
I threw out the door for doing it, but yeah, I guess it took balls.
Yeah, that's the thing. You know, it's like it's kind of a crapshoot of where you go, if they'll go for that or not. I mean, you could easily have also just gotten the boot out the door, depending on the company too. But I admire the guts to have done that. Regardless. So.
And what I did was I looked for every business that had a business listing that I could work for, that like a print shop or a t-shirt place or any place like that, mm-hmm. or a web design firm. And I drove there in person. I dropped off mm-hmm. resumes and digital portfolio copies mm-hmm. in person. And I said, can I talk to the creative director? And sometimes I got to talk to the creative director and I talked to them right then and there, you know, before anything. And
Ben's a hustler.
Well, what you have to do. That is exactly what you have to do. You have to figure out what you want to do in the career, mm-hmm. and then you have to figure out the way to get past everyone else that's an obstacle, mm-hmm. including other applicants are also obstacles. You have to make yourself stand out to where someone be like, "What about that guy? That guy sort of left an impression. I want to talk to him." That's how you get jobs,
right?
And everyone else says, oh, everyone else that was in my college graduating class, they said, oh, the job market's so bad, you can't find a job anywhere in the DFW area for graphic designers. And I didn't know what they were talking about, because what I did was, I just drove around and started dropping off resumes and talking to people in person and just, you know, getting my foot in the door any way possible. And I was able to get interviews. I was able to get five leads a week.
That's incredible. That's also your particular market too. And you have an idea. Me, I am starting from zero. I'm hoping to find my groove, Ben. That's what I'm trying to do.
It's once you figure out the kind of place you want to work at, just do that. Go there in person, apply in person, ask if you can talk to the person, do all these things. Do some research on the companies. Find out, you know, go to their website, find out the names of the people involved.
Mm-hmm.
Call the company's phone number, and if they have a digital switchboard, you can enter in the name of the person you want to talk to, and they'll send you over. I've done that lots of times. I've done that with big corporations and bypassed HR entirely and got interviews.
That's cool. All right. I'm not discounting any of your advice, Ben. I do appreciate it, and I admire your ability to just fucking do it is basically it. But I do got to get going right now, and I appreciate everybody here coming on to the show for this week. I bet Terrence has to get going to work soon, so.
Actually, today's public holiday, so I've been whining. It's been great.
Well, alrighty then. So,
like the one day I can stay on. Yes.
The one day. All right. I will talk to you guys later, and thanks again.
All right.
Sounds good. Good luck, guys.
Have a great one.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
See you later.